Have you tried going back and playing the games you played as a kid?
We're talking nostalgia overload, fun facts, and seeing if we can remember how to beat games we haven't played in 30 years.
Come join us. Retro Recall is all about nostalgia and reliving those years of zero responsibility.
Each episode, John makes me play a game from our youth, and I challenge him to do something in that game, and then the loser has to try one of the worst games ever made.
It's fun, it's terrible, but most of all, it's a look back at simpler times.
In the first episode, we try Double Dragon 2, and let's just say that John is still having nightmares about some of the terrible games he had to play.
You say that, but I'm not the only one. Ghoul School?
Dear God.
Check out Retro Recall on YouTube and your favorite audio podcast platforms.
There are links in the main show description, or just search Retro Recall.
Retro Recall. Come join us. Games are always better with friends.
Retro Recall.
Welcome to the Lord of the Rings Lorecast, the show that explores the background of Tolkien's amazing world from the very beginning.
For the very first time in The Hobbit, we are about to be introduced to not just dwarves traveling across the countryside and through mountains and forests and things like that, a small party of them of 12, but a much larger force, an army. In fact, this is one of the very few times where we actually have, in one of the stories, in the text of a novel, an army of dwarves. This is one of our only opportunities to understand what they are like, how they work, what their weapons are, what their armor is, how they organize their forces. We've gotten glimpses of other armies so far in The Hobbit. We have, of course, Bard's people, the people of Lake Town, and then, of course, the army of the Elven King in the forest, and we've got a good sense of how they organize, and also, because most of us have watched the movies, we've got a really good sense of the kinds of weapons and the kinds of armor for these different groups, and the movies do a pretty good job. They always take a little bit of a liberty here and there, but for the most part, fairly accurate. The dwarves, of course, show up in the Hobbit movie, and we get a good representation of them there, but the text, of course, is a little bit more detailed in specific ways than we really get a chance to really take a look at in the movies. And I think we're going to find that there is some technology and some strategy going on here with this dwarven army, Dain's people, that is absolutely worth noting, and a historic reason for why they are armed as they are. So here are a few things to keep in mind as we go through the text on this episode this week, and I'm going to dig a little bit deeper into the background and kind of stitch all the historical stuff together in the bonus episode this week, but you don't need to know all of that in order to understand what we are about to discuss. The army of the dwarves, Dain's people, who have come from the Iron Hills, have traveled from the east to the west in order to get to the Lonely Mountain. And what do we know about them? Well, we know quite a bit. These are veterans. These are not just any ordinary dwarves. These are not just the dwarves who happen to be available or owed, I don't know, the line of Thorin a debt of some sort. No, this is Thorin's cousin, Dain Ironfoot. Well, technically second cousin. They shared grandparents who were siblings for however that works. I believe that's second cousin, but feel free to correct me. And they are family. Dain is the leader of the dwarves of the Iron Hills. He is their lord. And he didn't come by that by accident or simply because he was lucky and he happened to be the next person in line of succession or anything like that. He earned it through battle, specifically in the war between the dwarves and the orcs. And this intro is going to go a little bit long because we need to get to the details here. That battle occurred over 100 years ago. And that might seem odd, but we have to remember that dwarves are long-lived. This is not like a battle that would have occurred for men, for example, because they'd all be dead. Now, when we're thinking about that war, we have to think about how did that war function and what was it about? And this is something that the movies change. They get it close, but they change it for very specific reasons, for the story, for keeping Azog alive and all of that stuff. But here's basically what happens. Thror decides to re-enter Moria back in 2790. Now, the current date in The Hobbit is 2941, so this is 150 years ago. And he is beheaded by Azog. That is how Thror dies. And not only that, Azog brands Thror's head with his name, beheads him, and tosses it out to his companion with a sack of gold and all of that. There's a whole thing there. But the most important thing to note here is that this was 150 years in the past. And it is told that Thorin's father, Thror, sits in silence for 7 days in order to deal with this travesty, probably from an emotional perspective, but also to decide what to do. After 7 days, he calls together all of the dwarven kingdoms in order to seek vengeance on the orcs. This can't be understated. This is all seven houses of the dwarves coming together in order to seek vengeance for the decapitation and shameful killing of one of their leaders, one of the heads of the houses. This was Thorin's grandfather. And Thrain, which I keep mispronouncing, then goes to war for 6 years against the orcs. Now, we have to think about how that battle was waged. For the most part, it was in caves and mines underground. This was not a conflict that would have, I don't know, destroyed villages and towns near the Misty Mountains. No, this was for the most part underground. And what would that combat have been like? Well, most of underground was not very large cavernous areas, but smaller tunnels and places like that. It's where the orcs lived. It's where the dwarves lived. So it makes sense. Now, if you were to go to war with a bunch of orcs underground, what kinds of weapons and armor would you use? And this is something that we're going to see in the text. And believe me, we're going to get there. But think about the dwarves. What do they normally use for weapons and armor? They are normally heavily armored. They are not wearing leathers or plate. They are wearing chainmail, lots of chainmail. And what kinds of weapons are they using? Well, they have axes, of course, but the types of axes that they use are called mattocks. Mattocks are kind of like pickaxes with a slim axe on one side and a pick point on the backside. Traditionally, these were used for mining and for getting rocks and things like that to break away from other pieces of rocks. But in the case of being underground against goblin forces by dwarves who are typically stockier and shorter and also have extremely strong upper body strength, something that is unwieldy for a human to wield would be very effective in these strong dwarven hands. They probably went to war with heavily armored dwarves with shields on the front lines, squeezed into these small hallway type situations, and then the line behind them probably used their mattocks in order to swing over the heads and down onto the heads of the orcs or goblins that were in front of them. And each dwarf also had a short broadsword, so they could pull that out at need when things got too close and swinging a mattock was a little bit ungainly still, I'm sure. And then they could stab at their enemies from the front line using these swords. And this was extremely effective underground because they were basically like a hard iron wall of points and axes that would progress towards the orcs in order to cut them to pieces. So this conflict lasted about 6 years, and most of the fighting was underground, but this conflict comes to a head at the Battle of Azanel Bazaar. Now, I just said the conflict comes to a head because in the movies, that's where Thor's head gets cut off. I didn't realize that was an unintended pun, I guess. But instead of that happening in the books, this is where the dwarves win the conflict. Now, maybe more accurately, we should say that the war ended here with the death of Azog. This battle is waged above ground outside of Moria, and Dain Ironfoot kills Azog, unlike in the movies, And the battle is conclusive. The dwarves win. They put an end to this conflict. Now, that of course doesn't mean that they're cool with the orcs or that the orcs now aren't going to seek vengeance for the death of their leader. But for the time being, in the year 2799, that conflict is done. The dwarves go home to their respective kingdoms, and of course, they still haven't taken back Erebor, and Moria is still a wreck, right? That's kind of how this all ends. So why go back through all of this? Because it's extremely important for this part of the story. These are the dwarves that are showing up. Dain Ironfoot himself, the killer of Azog, a guy who fought for 6 years with veteran soldiers at his side who are still here, still part of his 500 dwarven army, are now showing up to this event. Now, you have to understand, when you compare this smaller group of 500 dwarves to, say, the people of Laketown, there is a distinct difference here, right? They may not necessarily be more capable than, say, the elven forces. Those are formidable in their own ways. But compared to the people of Laketown, these people lost everything. They've been starving, and they've just pieced together some semblance of a force, picking up whatever weapons they could along the way, and they are not veterans of a 6-year war against orcs. They also aren't wearing tons of metal armor and are equipped to the nines. So there you go. That's the backdrop. And on top of it, Dain is the one who kills Azog. And the orcs and goblins aren't only seeking vengeance for Azog because, as we saw in The Hobbit, the party had to deal with the goblins under the mountain, and their king was killed there as well. Okay, so I think that sets the stage for you, and I know this was an extended intro, but I feel like it was important to review all of those details and make sure that those were all in line before getting into the text this week. So there you go. And with all of that in mind, let's talk about dwarves showing up to the battle of what becomes the Battle of Five Armies. That day passed and the night. The next day, the wind shifted west and the air was dark and gloomy. The morning was still early when a cry was heard in the camp. So this section of the story is about to introduce, of course, the dwarven army that's showing up. But before we even get that, we have a certain period of time that goes by. It's enough time for the dwarves to redouble their efforts to get there as quickly as possible and show up a little bit early. But we also get the line that the winds shifted west. Now, traditionally, when you declare that the winds are coming from the winds and a direction usually means the winds are coming from that direction. So the winds here have shifted to be coming from the west. This does a few things, right? Usually when the west is mentioned, it's a good omen because that's representative of Aman or Valinor, or the place where the Valar are and all of that. But in this case, I think that it might be doing something different because it mentions that the air was dark and gloomy. This is foreshadowing for the evil armies that happen to be coming from that direction, because that's just geographically where they're coming from. There's no greater meaning than that. But it also means that the winds are not coming from the east, the direction that the dwarves are traveling. And this plays into the story a little bit more as we move forward. Bard and his people get word from runners that the dwarves have appeared around the eastern spur of the mountain and were hastening to Dale. Now let's think about the geography. Why would they be going to Dale as opposed to the gate? They need to get around this spur of the mountain. Otherwise, they would have had to climb the mountain and come back down to the gate. So they have to go past the city of Dale on the way in. They don't have any other route to make it up to the actual entrance. If they could have gone another way or through another entrance into the mountain, which all of them are blocked up, they would have. But instead, they have to go this way through. And this is where we get descriptions about how they were armed and what they were like. Each one of his folk was clad in a hauberk of steel mail that hung to his knees, and his legs were covered with a hose of fine and flexible metal mesh. Basically, the dwarves are walking tanks. These must have been intimidating. Sure, they're short, but they're strong and they're covered in iron all the way down their legs, which was very uncommon for knights, or at least difficult for knights to do, because oftentimes knights who were clad in actual plate mail couldn't move very well. But if you covered your legs in a flexible mesh of metal, then you could still withstand blows and yet be mobile, and dwarves are strong. This would have been terrifying, not only because they were intimidating to look at and would be dangerous to fight, but because they wielded technology that nobody else had. The development of this type of armor was something only the dwarves had. Tolkien here says the secret of whose making was possessed by Dain's people. Then we get the description of the mattocks. They're two-handed, and like I described at the beginning, these are more like pickaxes than broad-bladed axes. The kinds of things that could break shields, that would shear right through different types of armor, or even break rock. They have short swords and round shields. They are equipped for anything. And on top of that, we get descriptions, of course, of their beards being forked and plaited, which meant braided, really, in our own use of the words today. I guess some people probably still say plaited, but around here, people say braided. And they were thrust into their belts, which is kind of a fun thing to think about and how that would look, but it makes sense because long beards were something that they were very proud of. But how do you keep the beards from getting in the way when you are fighting a battle? You tuck it in your belt so that it doesn't swing around and get chopped off or tangled in your arms or whatever. They also had metal caps and grim faces. These were not the kinds of dwarves you wanted to mess with. I don't know what kind of dwarf you would want to mess with, but there you go. And they very quickly make sure that they are understood. They send a group. Now, Dain isn't with the group, but they say they are sent from Dain, son of Nain, defining his ancestry, the importance, his authority, that sort of thing, and says that they're basically what they're doing. They're just straightforward. Hey, we are hastening to our kinsmen in the mountain. We're on our way to Thorin and his people in the place that they have authority to be in. And we learned that the kingdom is renewed. This is basically our land. What are you doing standing in our way? Tolkien writes, but who are you that sit in the plain as foes before defended walls? And then explains to us, this is a very polite way of saying, like, get out of our way, or we're going to consider you the enemy and we're going to go right through you. And then Tolkien defines for us that this is the only path that they could have gone. They have to go up this side of the river. It feels like it's less defended because there are less people on this side, at least that they can tell. We learn that Bard has placed soldiers up in the hills, especially archers, in order to kind of cover that area. The dwarves don't know about that yet, but they have to go through here. And Bard says, you can't. He puts his foot down and says, you're not going up there, for good reason. If these dwarves were to get to the stronghold, then the stronghold probably would never be broken. Thorin would never deliver the gold that he told them he would give them, and they would buy weeks of time, because we're explained here in the text that the dwarves are not just showing up with their weapons and the armor on their backs, but vast stores of supplies, packs on their backs. It makes me think of that Death Stranding game where you've got all the stuff on you. I didn't play it, but I've seen pictures and videos where he's carrying around all these boxes on his back. But again, dwarves are stocky and strong. They can carry a lot of supplies long distance very quickly, it seems. And they are set up. And if they were to get in there, the siege would be unending. And potentially Bard's people would never get what they wanted because they could revitalize the fortress, open other entrances. They didn't have enough men to surround the entire mountain. So this was Bard's one shot of making sure that he still got the treasure that was promised to him. Or at least that's what he thought. So these dwarven messengers go back, and of course they're muttering in their beards, which is a wonderful description. And Bard tries to go back up to Thorin and say, like, hey, where's our gold? You're supposed to give us stuff. And arrows came forth as soon as they were within shot, basically giving the impression that they're not actually going to hold up their end of the bargain because this dwarven army just showed up. They now have more leverage. Now, you might think that Bard would be dissuaded from even fighting with these dwarves. They've got so much experience and armor and weapons and things that his people don't have. But he believes that he has a counter to that. He even says that they are used to fighting underground and they don't understand. He's basically saying they don't understand the tactics of being above ground. He's hidden his archers and spearmen in the hills. And from that distance up in the hills, the dwarves would have a very hard time fighting back against them. And they could do great damage to this 500-member group. He talks with the Elven King, and the Elven King is like, let's hope this doesn't come to blows, because I really don't want to fight over gold, which is a very different perspective than we were given in the movies. And then he says, but if we need to deal with them, we have the advantage of numbers, and that should be enough. And then, unexpectedly, the dwarves move to attack. Now, this might feel aggressive at this point, but you have to remember, the dwarves know that they are on a time frame here. They have to get to the fortress. They have to get in that front gate. They need to get through the people who are in front of them before they are able to muster their forces in a way that is much more strategic and defensive and will keep them out. They also are veterans of a number of conflicts, and so they have their own strategic reasons for doing so right now, because it's, for the most part, it's a surprise, and they feel like they have the advantage. Again, they don't know about the forces in the hills, and they don't know the full extent of the elven army waiting to the west, on the other side of the river. And we're told that bows twanged and arrows whistled. Battle was about to be joined. This is the moment that would have been catastrophic for all of them had not something happened exactly at this moment. And of course, that wonderful climactic or eucatastrophic, that's a weird word to try to say, sort of way. We get this paragraph, and I love this. All right, let's do a magic trick. I'm going to list out three different stocking stuffers that I found at Uncommon Goods, and you will magically, in your mind, see the perfect people to give these gifts to. The Greatest Chocolates of the World Exploratory Set. A mug warmer that looks like a cute cat. A do-it-yourself solar-powered robot kit. Okay, maybe that last one was for me. But it worked, right? You pictured exactly who you'd give these to. Well, that's because Uncommon Goods is different from the regular store. The holidays are almost here. It's time to start buying your gifts, and you should go look for the highest quality, unique, and often handmade in the US gifts you can't find anywhere else. They have something for everyone. Moms, dads, kids, friends, sports fans, foodies, people who really like puzzles, all sorts of people. And shopping at Uncommon Goods supports artists and small businesses. Plus, Uncommon Goods gives back $1 to a nonprofit partner of choice with every purchase, and they've donated over $3.1 million to date. So don't wait. Make this holiday be the year that you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ringslore. That's uncommongoods.com/ringslore for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. I love it when the show gets really cool sponsors. And this time is no different. A brand new audiobook for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone is available now with, and get this, Hugh Laurie as Albus Dumbledore. Yes, Dr. House as Dumbledore. Now, you know me, I love fantasy stories. I love The Lord of the Rings. I love stories like Harry Potter, which were highly influenced by stories like Lord of the Rings. But listening to an audiobook version of this with Hugh Laurie and a cast of all of these different characters and actors who you might actually recognize. Matthew McFadden as Voldemort, Riz Ahmed as Severus Snape, Michelle Gomez as Professor McGonagall, Mark Addy as Rubius Hagrid, Kush Jumbo as the narrator, and that's just the beginning of the cast. Keira Knightley as Professor Umbridge, James McAvoy as Mad-Eye Moody, Kit Harington as Professor Lockhart, and get this, probably my favorite out of all of these, Matt Berry as Sir Cadogan, and Simon Pegg as Arthur Weasley. There's an entire new musical score, and you'll hear sound effects like echoes in hallways of footsteps, and the golden snitch buzzing past your head. Imagine listening to this with earbuds in. And it's out now on Audible. So all you have to do is go to audible.com/HP1 for Harry Potter. Again, that's audible.com/HP1. It's Harry Potter like you've never heard it before. Listen on Audible. Listen now. Still more suddenly, a darkness came on with dreadful swiftness. A black cloud hurried over the sky. Winter thunder on a wild wind rolled roaring up and rumbling in the mountain, and lightning lit its peak. And beneath the thunder, another blackness could be seen whirling forward. But it did not come with the wind. It came from the north, like a vast cloud of birds, so dense that no light could be seen between their wings. The nature imagery, the darkness, the winds, the lightning, and then, of course, bats. Bats blotting out the sky. These, of course, are being sent by the goblins, who are now marching to their position. But doesn't this feel a lot like other times where things are blotting out the sky in The Lord of the Rings? This feels like the return of the king, in a way. Now, we have to remember, of course, the orcs and goblins don't like the sunlight. They don't want to be out. So it makes sense that they'd be marching under dark clouds, and especially a sky blotted from the sun with just so many bats. And we get a description for how this works in The Lord of the Rings. Sauron would make vast clouds pluming into the sky and then send them forward to cover his armies. That was part of his tactic. We aren't really given the details here for these groups of orcs. Is that something similar that's happening here with them? Is this some sort of dark magic? Or is this just the natural encroachment of, I don't know, the clouds of winter, as it seems to be implying here? It seems as if Tolkien had to deal with this in this situation and then came up with a more fleshed out version of this type of thing when he wrote The Lord of the Rings. But it's still impactful. It is still something that would, for the people on the ground, make them second guess what they're doing right now, make them stop. And not just because this was dark and scary or something like that. Oftentimes, major weather type events were harbingers to ancient or, I don't know, medieval cultures of other signs of something else that's going on. And something else is going on here, because we have this really interesting juxtaposition with the way Gandalf shows up to everybody in this very situation. Notice the similarities here. "Halt," cried Gandalf, who appeared suddenly and stood alone, with arms uplifted between the advancing dwarves and the ranks awaiting them. "Halt," he called in a voice like thunder, and his staff blazed forth with a flash like the lightning. "Dread has come upon you all. Alas, it has come more swiftly than I guessed." His voice is like thunder, the staff is like lightning, just like what they see in the clouds coming over the mountain. Now, this isn't to say that he had something to do with those clouds. It's also not to say that he should be associated with the evil that is coming over the mountain. If anything, it's to say that he has authority over some of those natural forces, or at least feels like a natural force that is as shocking and as powerful as the thing they just witnessed. And here he is to stand in front of them and to use that same exact symbolism to great effect. He stops them in their tracks. And then he says this: "The goblins are upon you. Bolg of the North is coming. Odin, whose father you slew in Moria. Behold, the bats are above his army like a sea of locusts. They ride upon wolves, and wargs are in their train." Amazement and confusion fell upon them all. Even as Gandalf had been speaking, the darkness grew. The dwarves halted and gazed at the sky. The elves cried out with many voices. "Come," called Gandalf, "there is yet time for counsel. Let Dain, son of Nine, come swiftly to us." Now, normally I would leave you with that text because that's the last bit that we're going to cover here. But I just want to reinforce a few things here. Gandalf the Grey's mission was to bring together the people of Middle-earth. It was not to lead them in battle. That was not really his station. His mission was to build relationships, to understand the free people, their motivations, what they cared about. And you can see right here that he puts it to good use. He doesn't just say, "Hold on, everybody, there's a bunch of goblins and orcs and wargs coming. We better deal with them because they're more evil than all of us." Like, he doesn't use that justification. If anything, he very directly comments to the dwarves and says, very personally, "Bolg of the North, the son of Azog, is coming. Dain, remember, you slew his father. Now put two and two together, this guy's coming for your head." If you want to hold on to your head, you probably should band together. Let's get together and talk, because we've got an elven army, we've got a human army, we have a dwarven army, and we have a whole bunch of evil things headed this way that are going to take all of our heads. And by the way, wouldn't it be great for you to defend yourself against not just someone who's out for vengeance against you, but the very line of orcs who killed and shamed Thror, Thorin's grandfather? Your, I guess, second uncle? I don't really know how all that works. But you get it, right? Gandalf is appealing to what they care about. He's like the best salesman who ever lived and able to, well, convince people that they need to fight against the forces of darkness or they will all be dead. And I love this moment in The Hobbit because it is kind of like a mini Return of the King in a way. And when we, like Gandalf, understand all of their motivation and the fundamental ways that they work, it all comes together in such a brilliant, brilliant, well, battle of five armies. So there you go. And of course, we'll get deeper into this on the next episode, and I'll be right back to thank our patrons. Don't go anywhere. If you're looking for more background on the dwarves and the development of their technology and all of that, in the bonus episode this week, I'll be going into the background and how the information we have from the Silmarillion and the things the dwarves were making in the First Age, 6,000 years before this, led to the evolution of their equipment in the Third Age, and some of the other details around that. So feel free to join me, patreon.com/LordOfTheRingsLoreCast, if you'd like to sign up. And welcome to our newest patrons, Cole T, Max F, and Barrett E. Thanks for signing up. Thanks for joining me. I hope you're enjoying your ad-free episodes or your bonus episodes if you're signed up at that tier. And I have to shout out all of our VIP patrons. Fulcrum, David S., Daniel Nightweaver, Capenna, Richard J., TJT, AK Music Lover, Barney D., Azel Razzle, Lori B., Mason Weathertop, Jezzer, Gimli A Break, Divine Madman, Rosie Rose, Ginger Fury, Huon Is My Hero, Aldarion Was Right, Avariel, Matt, Party Snacks, Single Ent Looking for Ent Lives, Miltelu. I still messed that up. Norwegenius, Balragius, Hunteris, Bruce W., and Brent P., thank you so much for your continued support. Also, I haven't gotten a new review that I can see on Apple Podcasts in a while, so if you'd like to leave a 5-star review over there and recommend the show, leave some words, I'll read those out on a future episode, and it helps out a ton. People see these reviews not just on Apple, but they get kind of repurposed on other podcast platforms as well. So that's why I keep recommending that, because it really does help a lot. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed kind of a different sort of episode, a little bit more down in the weeds with things, but yeah, a little bit less text, a little bit more background. And of course, we're getting right into the Battle of Five Armies, and I look forward to getting into a little more of the minutia of what goes on with that over the next few episodes. So I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week. And if I'm going to see you on the other side with the bonus episode, I'll see you over there. Stay safe, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Lord of the Rings Lorecast. If you'd like to learn more about other fantasy worlds, check out my other podcasts, The Elder Scrolls Lorecast, The Witcher Lorecast, and more at robotsradio.net. If you'd like to reach out, I'd love to hear from you. Send me a note on Twitter at robots_radio. Or join our amazing community on the Robots Radio Discord. There are links in the show notes, or just search Robots Radio Discord, or find the link on robotsradio.net. I'll see you next time.
Have you tried going back and playing the games you played as a kid?
We're talking nostalgia overload, fun facts, and seeing if we can remember how to beat games we haven't played in 30 years.
Come join us. Retro Recall is all about nostalgia and reliving those years of zero responsibility.
Each episode, John makes me play a game from our youth, and I challenge him to do something in that game, and then the loser has to try one of the worst games ever made.
It's fun, it's terrible, but most of all, it's a look back at simpler times.
In the first episode, we try Double Dragon 2, and let's just say that John is still having nightmares about some of the terrible games he had to play.
You say that, but I'm not the only one. The Ghoul School?
Dear God.
Check out Retro Recall on YouTube and your favorite audio podcast platforms.
There are links in the main show description, or just search Retro Recall.
Retro Recall. Come join us. Games are always better with friends.
Retro Recall.